You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 178, in Steiner's Collected Works, a set of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Secret Brotherhoods and the Mystery of the Human Double. This is 7 lectures. I'm going to append 2 additional lectures that are in the original Collected Works volume, but have recorded for another book. Anyway, this is lecture 6 in the book, given in Dornach on the 19th of November, 1917, entitled Individual Spirit Beings and the Constant Foundation of the Universe, Part 2, translated by Joanna Collis. With regard to our present considerations, which I have linked to a description of an endeavor to find knowledge by inadequate means, and which have now led us to a wider historical perspective, let me begin both in this connection and in connection with what I said last time I spoke here, with the same purpose and out of the same impulse, by begging you to realize that I am talking about actual events, not some theory, not some system of ideas, but facts. This is the point we must be clear about, because otherwise it will be difficult to understand these things. Rather than propounding historical laws or ideas, I am telling you facts, facts that are connected with the intentions not only of certain individuals who are joined together in brotherhoods, but also of other beings who influence such brotherhoods, and whose influence is also sought by those brotherhoods, beings who are not incarnated in the flesh like human beings, but ones who have their body in the spiritual world. It is especially necessary to take account of this in the case of a fact such as the one I told you about yesterday. As I explained last year, these brotherhoods belong to different factions. I showed you last year that amongst these brotherhoods, there is one faction that is in favor of absolute secrecy about certain higher truths. Then, besides other shades of opinion, there are, especially since the middle of the 19th century, members of brotherhoods who are in favor of revealing certain truths to humanity carefully and with the necessary objectivity, but only those truths which it is immediately necessary to reveal. There are other nuances in addition to these two main factions. So you can see that the intentions, the impulses inserted by those brotherhoods into the evolution of humanity are likely to be a matter of compromise quite frequently. Those brotherhoods who know about the spiritual impulses at work in human evolution saw the approach of that important event of the early 1840s, the battle between certain spirits and some other higher spirits, which ended in 1879, when some spirits of an angel nature, spirits of darkness, fell victim to the event that is symbolized as the victory of Michael over the dragon. On seeing this, those brotherhoods had to decide how to react to it and had to ask themselves, what is to be done about it? Some members of the brotherhoods, who wanted to do what was right for that time, were to some degree motivated by the best intentions. But they were influenced by the erroneous impression that it was necessary to take account of the materialism of that time. As people anyway wanted to know about things in a physical way, those members of the brotherhoods were intent on teaching them something about the spiritual world by materialistic means, in a physical way. So it was out of good intentions that spiritualism was launched in the world during the 1840s. That battle took place, as I have pointed out, at a time when the attitude on earth was supposed to be a mainly critical one, an understanding directed solely toward the external world. It was necessary then that people had to be given at least an inkling, a sense, for the fact that there was a spiritual world all around them. And so, as happens with compromises, this compromise came about. Those members of such brotherhoods who were entirely against certain spiritual truths being made known to humanity found themselves overruled and had to give in and agree to the matter. It was not their original intention to put about in the world things that were connected with spiritualism. But where there are corporate bodies and where there is the will of corporate bodies, compromise ensues. And just as things are in external life, so are they in corporations. When a corporate body makes a decision, those who, for their own reasons, have worked toward this decision expect something from it. But those who were originally against it also have expectations once the decision has been made. Well-meaning spiritual members of the brotherhoods held the erroneous view that by using mediums they could convince people of the existence of a spiritual world all around them, and they thought that on the basis of that conviction it would then be possible to teach them about higher truths as well. This would indeed have been possible if the expectations of those well-meaning members of the brotherhoods had been realized. Namely, if what the mediums revealed had been interpreted as a sign that this was connected with a surrounding spiritual world. But something quite different happened, as I showed you yesterday. People who participated in these things interpreted what came through the mediums as coming from the dead. So what came about through spiritualism actually turned out to be disappointing for everyone. Those who had allowed themselves to be persuaded were naturally exceedingly disconcerted by the fact that one could talk of the spirits of the dead manifesting in the seances, especially as this was true in some cases. And the well-meaning progressive initiates had not expected any mention to be made of the dead, for they had thought people would talk of a general, elementary world. So they too were disappointed. Those who had been initiated in some way are primarily the ones who take note of such things. Apart from the already mentioned members of brotherhoods, there are also those who are members of other or even the same brotherhoods in which minorities or even majorities sometimes form. These other initiates must also be taken into account, and they were those within the brotherhoods who are termed, quote, brothers of the left-hand path, close quote, namely, those who make use, above all, of every kind of impulse involving matters of power that can be brought into human evolution. These brothers of the left-hand path, in their turn, also had all kinds of expectations about what came to light through spiritualism. I pointed out yesterday that brothers of the left-hand path were, in particular, those who made arrangements in connection with the souls of dead human beings. They were especially interested in what might come out of spiritualist seances. Gradually, they took charge of this whole field of activity. The well-meaning initiates gradually lost all interest in spiritualism, and indeed felt ashamed in some ways, because those who, from the beginning, had not wanted spiritualism, told them that they ought to have known from the start that nothing could come of it. This is how spiritualism, then, came to be taken over by, let us say, the power zone of the brothers of the left-hand path. Yesterday I mentioned those brothers of the left-hand path who were most of all disappointed when they saw that once spiritualism had been launched, it might reveal the very thing set in train by them, which they least of all wanted to have exposed. Those spiritualist seances were where the participants believed they were being influenced by the dead, might provide the very venue where messages from the dead could reveal what certain brothers of the left-hand path did with the souls of those who have died. Perhaps those very souls who had been misused by the brothers of the left-hand path would be the ones to manifest during the spiritualist seances. You must please remember that I am not speaking about theories, but about facts derived from individual people. And if those individuals are gathered together in brotherhoods, one of them might expect one thing from a fact, and another something else from the same fact. When one is speaking about real facts of the spiritual world, it is not possible to seek there anything that is not the result of individual impulses. In ordinary life, too, what one person does can contradict what another does. Theoretically, the law of contradictions cannot be gainsaid. And where facts are concerned, it happens frequently that facts in the spiritual world, too, are just as likely to be in disharmony as actions of human beings here on the physical plane. You must please always take this into account. In these matters, one cannot speak of realities if one does not speak of individual facts. So one must distinguish between the separate streams. One must peel them apart. This is connected with something very important, which we must be especially aware of if we want to arrive at a relatively satisfying view of the world. What I am going to say now is a matter of principle, and very important even though it is somewhat abstract. It is a fact to which we must for once pay attention. When working toward forming our view of the world, we strive, quite justifiably, to make sure that the different parts of our worldview harmonize with one another. We do this out of a degree of habit that could not be more justifiable, for it is bound up with all that has been humanity's most beloved treasure of soul and spirit for many centuries, monotheism. We want whatever we experience in the world to be traceable to a unifying foundation. This is entirely justifiable, but not from the angle people usually assume with justification, but from an entirely different angle about which we shall speak next time. Today, I only want to put before your souls what is principally important. Those whose approach to the world assumes that everything must be explicable without contradiction, owing to having been derived from a unifying foundation of the universe, those who have this assumption are in for many disappointments, especially if they make their approach to the world and its experiences with an open mind. This is so traditionally ingrained that we treat everything we see in the world in accordance with the pastoral view. Everything is derived from a unifying, divine, original foundation. Everything stems from God, so there must be a uniform explanation for everything. But this is not true. It is not so that all the experiences which surround us in the world stem from a unifying foundation. For in fact, everything stems from spiritual individualities who differ from one another. Various individualities join together to bring about the experiences that surround us in the world. Initially, this is how things are. Next time we shall speak about other aspects, which make monotheism justifiable. But in the first instance, this is how things are. As soon as we step across the threshold of the spiritual world, we must imagine individualities who are rather independent, in fact very independent of one another. And if this is so, then we cannot expect everything that happens to be explicable on the basis of a single unifying principle. Let us draw an experience. Let's say the experiences from 1913 to 1918. Of course, there are experiences before and after as well. Historians will always endeavor to assume that there is a unifying principle manifesting in this developmental path, but there is not. Once we step across the threshold to the spiritual world, it does not matter whether upward or downward, and there's a diagram, we find at work in these events various individualities who are relatively independent of one another. If you do not take this into account, if you assume that a unifying world foundation underlies everything, you will never reach an understanding of the events. You will only understand them properly if you take account of the fact that very varied individualities work either against or with one another in what might be termed the groundswell of events. All this is linked to the profoundest mysteries of human evolution, but the monotheistic feeling has concealed this fact for centuries, even millennia. It must, though, be taken into account. So if we want to make progress in matters of a worldview today, we must, above all, not mistake logic for abstract absence of contradiction. There can be no abstract absence of contradiction in a world where individualities who are independent from one another work together. So whenever the aim is to achieve an abstract lack of contradiction, this will lead to an impoverishment of concepts. Concepts will no longer be able to encompass the fullness of reality. Concepts can only encompass the fullness of reality if they are able to embrace that world of contradictions, which is in fact reality. The sphere of nature we see before us comes into being in a remarkable way. Various individualities work together to create nature, everything we call nature, and summarize on the one hand as natural science, and on the other as nature worship, nature aesthetics, and so on. But in the present cycle of human evolution, a wise guidance has seen to it that a very beneficial arrangement has been made for us. This enables us to conceive of nature by means of concepts relating to a unifying regulation, because through our senses we receive only those experiences of it that depend on such a unifying regulation. Behind the tapestry of nature, however, there lies something else, which receives its direction from quite another quarter. This, though, is excluded from our observation of nature. So, what we call nature is indeed a unified system, because everything else has been screened out. It is as though we perceive nature through the filter of our senses. Everything that is contradictory is filtered out, and the nature we have before us is thus a unified system. Once we cross the threshold, however, and include reality in our explanation of nature, the elemental beings, influences of human souls that can be directed toward nature, then we can no longer talk of nature as being a unified system. For then we also have to include the workings of individualities who either obstruct one another or support and strengthen one another. In the elemental world, there are spirits of earth, gnome-like beings, spirits of water, undine-like beings, spirits of air, sylph-like beings, and spirits of fire, salamander-like beings. They are all present there, but they do not carry on a unified regimen. These various realms, the gnomes, undines, sylphs, and salamanders, are independent of one another in some ways. They work not only in rank and file as part of a single system, but they also oppose one another. Their intentions are not linked from the beginning, so what comes about arises from the various ways in which their intentions mutually affect one another. If we know the intentions, we can see in what appears before us, for example, here are fire spirits and undines working together. but we must never believe that there is a single being behind them giving commands, for this is not the case. It is an attitude much held these days. Philosophers like Wundt, of whom Fritz Mautner said, not without reason, that he was an authority by the grace of his publisher, for indeed before the war he was regarded as an authority by almost the entire world, assume that the life of ideas, of feelings, and of will, everything living in the human soul, all belong in a single unit. They say the soul is a unit, so all these must have a single system in common. But this is not true. Those powerful and significant discrepancies found in human life, especially by analytical psychology, would not occur if beyond the threshold our life of ideas did not reach back into regions where it is influenced by individualities different from those influencing our feeling life, and different again from those of our life of will. It's quite extraordinary. Look, here is the human soul. There's a drawing. And within the human soul are the life of ideas, the life of feeling, and the life of will. There are three circles. Someone like Wundt, who likes systems, cannot imagine this to be anything but one single system. If the life of ideas leads to one world, W1, the life of feeling to another world, W2, and the life of will to another world again, W3, that is the very function of the human soul, to create a unit for something that is threefold in the pre-human world as matters stand at present. Account has to be taken of all these things when one considers the impulses that are to be incorporated into human evolution. I have said during these lectures that every period of the post-Atlantean age has its own specific task, and I have given a general direction of the task of the fifth post-Atlantean period by saying that it will be up to humanity during this period to come to grips with evil as an impulse in the world. We have talked variously about what this means. It is essential that the forces which manifest as evil, if they appear at the wrong place, must be taken in hand by human endeavor in the fifth post-Atlantean period, in such a way that humanity can achieve something with these forces of evil that will be beneficial for the future of the whole of world evolution. I'm going to read that again. It is essential that the forces which manifest as evil, if they appear at the wrong place, must be taken in hand by human endeavor in the fifth post-Atlantean period, in such a way that humanity can achieve something with these forces of evil that will be beneficial for the future of the whole of world evolution. Because of this, the task of this fifth post-Atlantean period is an especially difficult one. You see, a great many temptations will be visited on humanity as time goes on. When little by little the powers of evil make their appearance, human beings may naturally be much more inclined to give in to this evil in every field, instead of taking up the fight to bring what seems evil to them into the service of world evolution in the sense of what is good. Yet this is what must come about. To a certain degree, evil must be placed at the service of world evolution in the good sense. Failing this, it will be impossible to enter into the sixth post-Atlantean period, which will have an entirely different task. Although human beings will still be linked with the earth, the task will be to enable them to look continuously into the spiritual world and live in spiritual impulses. Connected with the task of the fifth post-Atlantean period concerning evil, there is the possibility that a certain kind of personal darkening for human beings could arise. As we know, since 1879, there have been, within the human kingdom, spirits of darkness, who are the next closest to humanity and belong to the kingdom of the Angeloi. They are here because they have been turned out of the spiritual world. So now they live in and through human impulses. The fact that there are beings invisibly amongst us who are so closely related to human beings, and that human beings are prevented by the way forces of evil play into their lives from recognizing the spirit with their reason, which is the task of the fifth post-Atlantean period related to this, means that in this fifth post-Atlantean period, there will be many opportunities for people to succumb to obscure errors and such like. During this fifth post-Atlantean period, we must make the effort to comprehend the spiritual through our reason. The spirit will be revealed, that is certain. Because the spirits of darkness were overcome in 1879, more and more spiritual wisdom will be able to flow down from the spiritual worlds. For those spirits would only have been able to prevent this if they had remained up above in the realms of spirit. They can no longer prevent spiritual wisdom from flowing down. But what they can do is create confusion and bring obscurity to human souls. The opportunities that are being taken to create this obscurity have already been described to some extent. We have already talked about the kind of arrangements that are being made to prevent human beings from receiving the life of the Spirit. All this does not, of course, give cause for lamentation and such like, but provides a strengthening of the power and energy of the human soul in its leaning toward the Spirit. If what can be achieved is achieved by human beings during this fifth post-Atlantean period, through incorporating the forces of evil in the good sense, then at the same time, something else, something tremendous, will also be achieved. The fifth post-Atlantean period will then know something grander for the evolution of humanity than has ever been known by any earlier period of Earth evolution. For example, Christ appeared to the fourth post-Atlantean period through the mystery of Golgotha. But only now can the fifth post-Atlantean period absorb him by human reason. Human beings in the fourth post-Atlantean period were able to comprehend that in the Christ impulse they had something that would lead them, as souls, beyond death. That has been made sufficiently clear by Pauline Christianity. But something even more significant will occur for the development of the fifth post-Atlantean period when human souls recognize that in Christ they have the helper they need to transform the forces of evil into good. There is one thing connected with this feature of the fifth post-Atlantean period, one thing which one should inscribe anew into one's soul every day, one thing which one should not forget, even though human beings are particularly prone to forget this particular thing. This is that in this fifth post-Atlantean period, the human being must be a warrior for the spirit. Human beings must experience how their forces ebb away if they do not continuously hold them in check for the purpose of winning through to the spiritual world. In this fifth post-Atlantean period, human beings stand on their freedom to the highest degree. This is something they have to go through with. The idea of human freedom is the yardstick against which must be measured everything that human beings meet with during this fifth post-Atlantean period. For were their forces to weaken, this could cause everything to turn out for the worst. In this fifth post-Atlantean period, human beings are not in the situation of being led like children. If there are certain brotherhoods whose ideal it is to lead human beings like children, as they were led in the third post-Atlantean period and in the fourth, then these brotherhoods are not doing what is right. They are not doing what actually ought to be done for the evolution of humanity. Anyone who speaks about the spiritual world must do so in a way that leaves people free to accept or reject what he is saying. Someone speaking about the spiritual world in this fifth post-Atlantean period must constantly remind himself of this. Because of this, certain things can only be said in this fifth post-Atlantean period, and the actual saying of these things is now just as important as anything else was in other periods. I will give you an example of what I mean. In our time, the most important thing is to bring forward truths. Put plainly, to give lectures about truths. What people then do about this is up to their freedom. One should go no further than to lecture on, to communicate truths. Whatever consequences there are should follow as a free decision, just as consequences follow when decisions are made out of the impulses one has on the physical plane. It is exactly the same in the case of things that can only be guided from the spiritual world itself. It will be easier to understand this if we go into some detail. Even as late as the fourth post-Atlantean period, other things besides the word, besides mere information, came into consideration. What were these? Let us take a specific example. The island of Ireland, as we call it today, has some quite special features. Certain characteristics make this island of Ireland different from any other place on earth. Every region of the earth differs from the others in certain respects, so as such this is nothing out of the ordinary. Today, though, I want to stress the relatively marked difference that exists between Ireland and other parts of the earth. As you know from my book title and outline of Esoteric Science, by looking at the facts that can be gleaned from the spiritual world, we can go back in time and note certain influences and events in the evolution of the earth. You know from an outline how things were in what we call the Age of Lemuria. You know what went on in that age and how various aspects developed. Well, yesterday I drew your attention to the necessity of viewing the earth as an organism, and how in different regions it sends out different streams that influence the inhabitants. These streams of influence have a particular effect on the double about which I spoke at the end of yesterday's lecture. In the case of Ireland, the human beings who knew it in olden times described its very special characteristics in the form of fairy tale or legend. An esoteric legend was known to express the being of Ireland within the earth's organism. What people said was this: once upon a time, humanity was driven out of paradise because Lucifer had led humanity astray in paradise. So humanity was scattered across the rest of the world. The rest of the world already existed at the time when humanity was driven out of paradise. So this legendary fairy tale description distinguishes between paradise with Lucifer in it and the rest of the earth into which humanity was driven. But Ireland is different, for it does not belong to the rest of the earth in the same sense, because before Lucifer entered paradise, a likeness of it came into being upon the earth, and this likeness became Ireland. So please understand this. Ireland is that portion of the earth that has no share in Lucifer, that portion to which Lucifer has no connection. The part which had to be separated off from paradise, so that an earthly likeness could arise, would have prevented Lucifer from entering into paradise. So according to this legend, Ireland was seen as the separated off part of paradise, which would have prevented Lucifer from entering into paradise. Only when Ireland had been separated off was it possible for Lucifer to enter paradise. This esoteric legend, which I have represented very imperfectly here, is something most beautiful. For many, it explained Ireland's centuries-long unique task. In the first mystery play I wrote, I touched on how the Christianization of Europe was started by Irish monks. After Patrick had introduced Christianity to Ireland, it took on there the most deeply pious form. The Greeks called Ireland Ierna, and the Romans Ivernia. During the time when the best impulses of European Christianity emanated from Ireland, from Irish monks lovingly initiated into Christianity, the piety of Irish monasteries led to Ireland being called the Isle of Saints, as though in a new interpretation of the legend. This is linked also with the fact that the forces I mentioned, which rise up out of the earth and take hold of the human double, are of the very best kind in the island of Ireland. You might want to say that if this is the case, the very best human beings must live in Ireland. But this is not how things are in the world. Every region has migrants coming in who have descendants and so on. People are not solely the product of the one particular piece of ground they stand on. People's character might quite well contradict what rises up out of the earth. So one must not characterize a specific region of the earth's organism by pointing out what actually develops in the people there. This would be to succumb to the world of illusion. But we can certainly say, as I have just said, that Ireland is indeed a very special location. Such a statement might provide a factor that could lead to fruitful ideas in social politics. Factors like this one I have mentioned in connection with Ireland are factors that should be reckoned with. All these things should be viewed together. There ought to be a science about the shaping of human circumstances on the earth. Before such a science comes into being, there can be no really positive outcome in the way public affairs are managed. What can be said on the basis of what comes from the spiritual world ought to flow into the arrangements that are made. That is why I have been stressing in public lectures how important it is for all those who are involved in public affairs, statesmen and the like, to get to know these things. Not unless they do so will they be able to take control of reality. They have not done it and are not doing it, yet it is what is necessary. Today, in accordance with the tasks of the fifth post-Atlantean period, the important thing is to say these things, to bring them forward. Before what is said can be put into action, decisions have to be taken based on impulses arising on the physical plane. This was not so in former times, when matters were handled differently. At a specific point in time during the third post-Atlantean period, a certain brotherhood caused a good-sized group of people from Asia Minor to go and colonize the island of Ireland. The people who settled in Ireland came from the region of Asia where the philosopher Thales was later born. You can read about the philosophy of Thales in my book titled The Riddles of Philosophy. Thales hailed from the same region, but later, for he was not born until the fourth post-Atlantean period. Those initiates sent the colonists to Ireland from the same milieu, the same spiritual substance, from which the philosopher Thales later stemmed. Why? They did this because they were aware of the special characteristics of a region of the earth such as that where Ireland is situated. They knew about what is hinted at in the esoteric legend about which I spoke just now. They knew that the forces rising up out of the earth through the soil of the island of Ireland work on human beings in such a way that they are little influenced toward becoming intellectual, little influenced toward becoming egoistic, and little influenced toward being able to take decisions firmly. The initiates who sent those colonists knew this very well, and they selected people whose karmic inclinations seemed to make them suitable for being exposed to the influences of the island of Ireland. Today, there are still descendants in Ireland of that ancient population, transplanted so long ago from Asia Minor, who were to develop so as to have not even a trace of intellectuality, not a trace of reason, and not the ability to take firm decisions. On the other hand, they were to develop special qualities of heart and soul. Thus preparations were made beforehand for the peaceful spread of Christianity in Ireland, and that glorious development of Christianity in Ireland, which then spread out into the Christianization of Europe. All this was prepared beforehand. Compatriots of Thales, who came later, sent people who then proved to be suited to become monks, able to work in the way I have suggested. Such enterprises were frequent in olden times. So, when you hear historians who do not understand this, though of course they have plenty of understanding of the kind that can be found lying in the street, when you hear these historians describing those people of ancient times, you must always be aware that such colonizations were imbued with profound wisdom. They were guided and steered always with an eye to what was to take place in the future, and account was always taken of the special characteristics of the earth's evolution. That was a different way of bringing spiritual wisdom into the world. Nowadays, those treading the right path are not permitted to act like this. They may not force people against their will to get distributed around the earth. What they have to do today is tell people the truth, and it is then up to them to act. So you see, considerable progress has taken place from the 3rd and 4th to the 5th post-Atlantean period, and it is something of which one must be very well aware. One must realize how this impulse of freedom must run like a thread through everything that governs the 5th post-Atlantean period. It is this freedom of heart and soul which is so strongly objected to by that opponent about whom I have told you, that he accompanies the human being from before birth and until death, but who has to depart before death actually takes place. Under the influence of this double, a great deal can emerge which is able to emerge during this 5th post-Atlantean period. A great deal which in the battle with evil is, however, not inclined to give this 5th post-Atlantean period the possibilities it needs to achieve its goal of enabling the evil to be transformed into good to some extent. Consider, then, what must lie behind all those things in which the human beings of the 5th post-Atlantean period are involved. The correct light must be thrown on the individual facts. They must be understood. Where the double is strongly at work, that is where the true tendency of the 5th post-Atlantean period is being counteracted. But humanity, in this 5th post-Atlantean period, has not yet reached the point of being able to assess these facts properly. Especially in these past 3 sad years, humanity has not been at all inclined to assess the facts at all in any proper way. Let us look at a fact that has seemingly no connection with what I have been speaking about today. Here is the fact. At a large iron foundry, tens of thousands of tons of cast iron were to be loaded onto railway trains, and a certain number of laborers had to be employed for this purpose. It was decided to put 75 men on this job, and it turned out that they were each able to load 12.5 tons per day. So 75 men were to load 12.5 tons each per day. There is an individual, Taylor, who is more concerned with the double than with what would promote the progress of the human heart and soul in the 5th post-Atlantean period. This man asked the manufacturers whether they did not think that a single man could load much more than 12.5 tons per day. The manufacturers thought that one worker could load as at most 18 tons per day. So, Taylor said, let's make an experiment. So Taylor began to experiment with human beings, thus transferring the element of the machine into human social life. He was going to do experiments with human beings. He tested whether what those most practically minded manufacturers said was true, whether one man could really load only 18 tons per day. He introduced rest breaks, calculated physiologically, to allow for the recoupment of as much energy as had been expended. Of course, it became obvious that this varied from person to person. As you know, such variation cannot be applied to mechanical procedures. You have to take the arithmetical average. But with human beings, you cannot take the arithmetical average, because every individual has a right to his own existence. But Taylor took the arithmetical average. He selected those workers whose break times, overall, were economical. And these economical break times were allowed. The others, who could not recoup their strength in these break times, were simply thrown out. In human experiments like these, it turned out that if you selected those workers who recovered fully in the allotted breaks, then every man was able to load 47.5 tons. Thus, the mechanism of Darwin's theory is applied to the life of working men. Throw out those who do not fit. Select those who do. Those who fit are the ones who can load not 18 tons, as had previously been thought, but 47.5 tons when given the required rest breaks. This also makes it possible to satisfy the workers' wishes, because when a lot of money is saved, their wages can be increased by 60%. So the ones who are selected, the ones who are best fitted for the struggle for existence, can in addition be turned into very satisfied fellows. But the ones who do not fit might as well starve. This is how a principle is born. Little note is taken of such things, because they are not examined in the light of wider perspectives. But one must examine them in the light of wider perspectives. Today, this is nothing more than an erroneous application of scientific ideas to human life. But the impulse is there. And then it begins to be applied to those things that make their appearance as esoteric truths during the fifth post-Atlantean period. There is nothing esoteric in Darwinism. Nevertheless, if it were to be applied more widely, it would lead to much frightfulness. Namely, if it were to be applied to direct experimentation with human beings. If the esoteric truths that must be revealed during the course of the fifth post-Atlantean period were to be added, though, then one would gain immense power over people merely through always selecting the most suitable. But it would not remain merely a matter of selecting the most suitable, for by striving to achieve a certain occult invention that would make the most suitable ever more and more suitable, one would achieve immense power that would work counter to the good tendencies of the fifth post-Atlantean period. I wanted to show you how these things hang together in order to demonstrate what the early beginnings of wider intentions for the future look like and why it is necessary to throw light on them from a higher perspective. Next time, it will be our task to point out the 3 or 4 great truths which must be arrived at by the fifth post-Atlantean period. We shall show how these truths can be misused if they are not applied in the sense of the right and good tendencies of the fifth post-Atlantean period, but instead are made to fulfill the conditions of the double. Conditions represented by those brotherhoods who want to replace Christ by another being. The end of Lecture 6.